Thank you, Chairperson, and let me thank the organizers for putting together this, what I'm sure is going to turn out a very exciting program. I am Rafi Dipuchoto, and indeed I'm going to talk about four terminal resistance measurements in ballistic wires. Listed here are a group of people who were essential for this project. This project was done at Bell Labs. The people, Lauren Pfeiffer and Ken West, which are the crystal growers, are really essential in the sense that you're going to see some very fancy, so to speak, MBE growth, and the ability to do these kind of structures is very crucial for what I'm going to talk about. Essentially, this talk, the plan of this talk is to explain in some details this type of data. What is plotted here is two types of resistance measurements performed on a one-dimensional wire. One of them, the blue line, is a two-terminal measurement, and it's plotted against the gate voltage, which controls the density in the 1D, or the number of occupied one-dimensional modes, and you see that the resistance grows in a step-like manner. This region here is a single-mode wire. You see that the two-terminal resistance is quantized and finite. The green line is a four-terminal resistance performed on the same piece of wire, and you see that for a single-mode wire, the resistance is essentially zero. It is vanishingly small. So I'm going to be talking about the subtleties about this type of four-terminal measurements. I'm going to be reminding you of some older piece of physics that was discussed some 10 or 20 years ago. Then I'm going to tell you how we attack these subtleties experimentally. I'm going to concentrate on a particular realization of a 1D system, the cleaved edge overgrowth wires. I'm going to go in some details how we fabricate them, and then relate this to, again, performing these type of measurements. So let me start with some trivialities. Everybody here is familiar with the Drude model, which essentially states that when we apply an electric field on a piece of a conductive solid that has some free charges, the electric field is going to exert a force on the electrons. They're going to accelerate, but there are also going to be collisions. These electrons are going to collide with a disorder or what have you. And the net effect of this multiple collisions effect is going to be some frictional force. And it is really the balance between the frictional force and the driving force which gives rise to the resistivity of the material. So we can ask a simple question. What happens when we make the sample cleaner and cleaner? So suppose we can create a situation where there is absolutely no scattering. Then one would expect from this naive model that since there is no friction, there would be actually no resistance to such a sample. Perhaps the simplest example of a realization of such a scattering-free system is a one-dimensional, single-mode one-dimensional wire. We know experimentally from these systems that when we perform a two-terminal measurement on such a wire, we actually find a resistance which is not zero, and in fact, it's not even small. It is given by the quantum of resistance of about 13 kilo-ohms. We can perform a calculation, a simple calculation, which essentially boils down to counting electrons flowing down such a wire with a given applied voltage. And what we find is that indeed, from this calculation, we expect the resistance to be non-zero and given by the quantum of resistance. So what I would like to stress here is that the surprising thing is that the result of this calculation is a resistance which is actually finite, although we assume that there is no scattering, no backscattering inside the wire. On the other hand, if we adopt another approach, the Landauer scattering approach, which turns out to be very useful to think about these systems. This approach relates the scattering of electronic waves of some potential landscape. The scattering properties of these waves are related to overall quantities like the resistance of the material. And Landauer used this approach to calculate the resistance of a potential barrier embedded in a one-dimensional object. And what he found, this famous Landauer resistance formula, he found that the resistance of this barrier is proportional to the ratio between the reflection coefficient and the transmission coefficient through this barrier. So if you imagine making this obstacle, this barrier, smaller and smaller, the transmission is going to grow approaching unity and the reflection is going to approach zero, so this Landauer resistance is going to vanish. This is in contrast to what I told you before, that for a clean ballistic wire, we can calculate the resistance, which is non-zero. So there was this question of which one of these two formula is the right one, and I think it was Joe Imrie that pointed out for the first time that in fact both of these formula are right. They just correspond to different physical quantities. The Landauer resistance corresponds to the resistance of the barrier itself, while the previous resistance I was talking about corresponds to an overall resistance that has to do with connecting a macroscopic large reservoir into a one-dimensional object. This object is then interrupted by the barrier and connected to yet another macroscopic reservoir on the other side. And one can use the same Landauer scattering approach to calculate now this overall resistance, and indeed one finds that this two-terminal resistance is now proportional to 1 over the transmission coefficient of the barrier. So even if the barrier is essentially absent, so that the transmission is unity, this resistance remains finite. And Imrie pointed out that if you simply take the difference between these two quantities, you find that the difference is a universal constant, the quantum of resistance. So we can think about the quantum of resistance as a resistance that is a contact resistance, namely, it is a penalty we have to pay by going from a macroscopic reservoir into a one-dimensional channel. And if you divide this resistance equally between these two contacts, you find a contact resistance which is half the quantum resistance. So the picture that I'm going to have in mind for transport in the ballistic wire is drawn here. I have some macroscopic objects that are connected into the wire. There is some penalty having to do with narrowing down this reservoir into the wire. And the motion of electrons inside the wire is pretty much ballistic. We can translate this language to a language of an electrochemical potential. What we find is that electrons that come are injected from the source into the wire, they are of course injected at the electrochemical potential of the source. And as long as we assume that there is no scattering inside the wire, there are no these electrons have no means to change their electrochemical potential. So all the electrons moving to the right inside the wire are going to have an electrochemical potential equal to the one of the source. And under the same token, electrons coming from the drain propagating to the left in the wire are going to have a different electrochemical potential, the one equal to the one of the drain. So inside the ballistic wire, we can have a situation where we have two distinct electrochemical potential, and this has much to do with the fact that we assume that there is no backscattering, so these two species, left movers and right movers, they obey separate conservation laws, and they do not talk to each other. So contact resistances have been with us, I think, since we started doing electrical measurements. And there are well-established ways to circumference the complication of contact resistances. If we would like to know the internal resistivity of some sample, we perform a four-terminal measurement. What this amounts to is we use two contacts to drive a current through the sample, and then we use two separate voltage probes to probe the electrochemical potential at two different locations, and then we can relate this information to the internal resistivity of the sample. The only important point is that we would like to attach this voltage probe in such a way so that we do not disturb the pattern of the current flow. And then we can deduce the internal resistivity correctly. And this point exactly turns out to be very difficult in 1D. If we just put two additional voltage probes onto a one-dimensional object, you immediately see that we essentially break the wire into three pieces. There are going to be contact resistances at each intersection, so that even between the two internal voltage probes, there are still two contact resistances that we have to deal with. So this is the first difficulty. There is yet another difficulty having to do with the following. If we have a diffusive sample and we attach a voltage probe to it, the size of the voltage probe is much larger than, let's say, the momentum relaxation mean free path, then from very general considerations, we know that under the condition of zero net current flow between this voltage probe and the sample, the voltage probe is going to acquire an electrochemical potential equal to the local electrochemical potential in the neighboring region in the sample. When the mean free path becomes larger than the size of the voltage probe, we have to think a little bit harder what it is exactly that the voltage probe measures. I just told you that in a ballistic wire, we can have two different electrochemical potentials for left movers and right movers. So we have to think how this voltage probe is going to couple to the system and what it is going to measure. We can, of course, force the local electrochemical potential to be equal to the one of the probe by crossing the sample, but this will be an invasive measurement. It actually changes the properties of the sample that we are trying to measure. So the aim is going to be to avoid invasive measurements. What we would like to do is to probe the properties of our ballistic wire without disturbing it, at least without disturbing it too much. So in order to explain to you how we managed to do that, let me introduce the cleaved edge overgrowth wires. The way these wires are prepared is the following. We start by fabricating a very high quality two-dimensional electron gas in a gallium arsenide, aluminum gallium arsenide heterostructure. 2D gas resides in a gallium arsenide quantum well sandwiched between two aluminum gallium arsenide layers. Then we take the substrate and we cleave it inside the growth chamber of the MBE machine. And we, by doing so, we expose a very clean and atomically flat 0-1-1 surface, which is immediately overgrown by an additional modulation doping sequence. So there is an additional modulation doping overgrowth sequence overgrowth, which locally enhances the electronic density near one of the edges of these two-dimensional electron gas. This density enhancement comes about in the form of bound states, states that are bound to the cleaved edge interface, and electrons occupying these states are free to propagate only along one of the edges of the two-dimensional electron gas. So the electronically active regions in a cleaved edge overgrowth sample look something like that. There is a two-dimensional electron gas sheet, and then there are 1D states bound to one of the to this cleaved edge overgrowth interface and free to propagate only along the edge. The way we are going to measure this system is we introduce a gate at the top surface, and we use this gate to deplete the two-dimensional electron gas from underneath the gate, but we can leave out the 1D modes along the edge in front of the gate. Because the local density here is higher, we can actually arrange for these modes to remain occupied. And this geometry lends itself quite easily to performing two terminal measurements on the cleaved edge overgrowth wire. What we're going to measure is we're going to measure this section of the wire here, which is isolated, the piece of wire in front of the gate. These types of measurements were performed some 3 or 4 years ago by Amir Yaacobi, and the result is shown here. This is the conductance, the two-terminal conductance against, again, the gate voltage, which controls the density now in the 1D in front of the gate. And you see a well-developed conductance plateaus characteristic of ballistic transport in 1D. The only thing that is so to speak, wrong with this data is the fact that the conductance step height, or the contribution of each channel to the overall conductance, is smaller than the expected value of 2E squared over H, and it is smaller by some 20% in this case, and the exact number actually depends on structure parameters. So what is observed is a conductance which is pretty much quantized, yet it is not universal, it depends on structure parameters. So the conductance is slightly smaller than what we expect, which means the resistance is slightly larger. And the question that arises is whether this extra resistance is internal to the wire, or is it a property of the contacts that we're using. I told you that contacts to 1D have this property of having half the quantum resistance as a contact resistance. This is not, of course, any other contact that you're going to fabricate is going to have this value. This is the minimal possible value for contact resistance to 1D, and it appears for a very special geometry in which you narrow down the macroscopic contact very slowly, adiabatically, to form the wire at the very end. So the contacts that we are using in Clip the Jovo Gauss wires are really an interface between the two-dimensional electron gauze and the wire. The reason being that we contact electrically the two-dimensional electron gauze sheet on one side. We push a current that then has to couple somehow from the 2D into the 1D, and then couple from the 1D into the 2D on the other side. So we would like to first study the properties of these contacts, and then what I'm going to show you is that we can actually use this information to prepare non-invasive voltage probes or voltage probes with controlled invasiveness to perform four terminal measurements on a ballistic wire. And the approach that we are going to take is instead of having just single gate on the top surface, we have two of them. And this allows us to separate out a strip of a two-dimensional electron gauze, and we can control the width of this strip by controlling the distance between the gates. So we control the length over which this two-dimensional electron gauze width, this two-dimensional electron gauze strip taps into the wire from the side. If this width is zero, then there is no two-dimensional electron gauze and the wire is undisturbed. If we make this width very, very large, then we establish a good contact between this tap and the wire. Now, why do we have any reason at all to suspect that the contacts, this 2D, 1D contact is less than ideal? The reason has to do with the electrostatics of this structure. If we think about the electrical potential inside the gallium arsenide quantum well along a cut along this blue line here, then the picture is going to look something like that. If we go far away into the bulk, then the conduction band is flat and lies below the Fermi level. This is the two-dimensional electron gauze in the bulk. But as we approach the cleaved edge, because of this modulation doping that we introduced here, there is a built-in electric field, and the conduction band bends down and creates this triangular well at the very edge. So this potential landscape supports a few bound states. These are the 1D. And then a continuum, which is a two-dimensional electron gauze. If that was the end of the story, then there would have been absolutely no coupling between the 2D gauze and the 1D, because all these states are orthogonal. In reality, of course, there will always be some amount of disorder which would relax this constraint, and there will be some finite coupling between the two. But depending on disorder, the coupling can be less than ideal. Sort of further explain this point, if we think about the dispersion of electrons, for the 1D bound state, it starts lower in energy as compared to the 2D, which automatically means that the Fermi wave vector in the 1D is larger than the Fermi wave vector in the 2D. So there is a momentum mismatch, and we need some disorder in order to allow for scattering between the 2D and the 1D. This momentum mismatch, by the way, is not small in our structures. One can still argue that this momentum mismatch is going to lead to a high resistivity of this interface, the 2D, 1D interface, that is resistance per unit length. But just by accumulating a longer and longer contact, we can drag this the overall resistance to negligible layers and negligible levels. It turns out that this is not the case for a very simple reason. That is, if an electron scatters from the 2D into the 1D, far away from the entrance to this isolated wire region, then this electron can, of course, scatter back into the 2D. But even worse, it can undergo a backscattering event inside the 1D. And then this electron is propagating in a very clean one-dimensional wire, but completely in the opposite direction. It has very little chances of entering the isolated wire region. So the overall resistance of the contact is going to be established by a competition between 2D 1D scattering and 1D backscattering. Yes, it is temperature dependence, and it tends to improve as you raise the temperature. By the way, the experiments that I'm going to show you are all done at 300 millikelvin. This is going to be true throughout the talk, and these are linear response, so that the overall voltage is smaller than temperature.
Improve means become smaller. The resistance becomes smaller.
Yes, approaching the quantum resistance. Okay, so we're going to use these kind of structures to study the properties of this 2D, 1D interface. And as I said before, we have two very simple limits. If we make this two-dimensional electron gas strip very thin so that it doesn't disturb the wire, imagine for a minute that I'm putting these two gates together so that there is no two-dimensional electron gas strip here, then I just have one wire. But instead of having a length of a single gate width, it now has double the length because I have two gates. But the resistance of a ballistic wire doesn't depend on its length. So actually, in this limit, I expect that the conductance of the combined system with the two gates is going to be equal to the conductance of each one of its parts, so the conductance of a single gate. In the other hand, if I have a very wide two-dimensional electron gas strip so that it establishes a very good contact between the 1D and the 2D, then I have two wires that are connected in series, and I expect a classical behavior because of the presence of this reservoir. So in this limit, I expect that the overall resistance is just going to be twice the resistance of each wire, so the conductance is going to be half the conductance of each wire. And this behavior is exactly what we see in the experiment. It is shown here in this view graph, which is kind of busy, so let me walk you through it. We start by characterizing each one of the wires in front of the two gates by activating one gate at a time. And we see these conductance steps. These are the dashed lines, both in the figure and in the inset. We use this type of measurements to identify the gate voltages needed to sustain, let's say, a single mode in front of one of the gates. Then we fix the voltage applied to this gate so there is a single mode here, and we measure the overall conductance as a function of the voltage applied to the second gate. The result for a relatively wide two-dimensional electron gas strip here, 10 microns, is shown in the inset by the red line. You see that as I reduce the number of modes now in front of the second gate, the conductance goes down. And when the device is symmetric, this shaded region here corresponds to a single mode in front of both of these gates, the conductance is half the conductance of each wire. So this is the classical behavior I was talking about. We just have two wires connected in series. Classically, the conductance is half the conductance of each wire. We see a very different behavior when we have a very narrow strip here of 2 microns. Then the overall conductance is almost equal to the conductance of each wire. So this clearly shows that we can have a ballistic transport of electrons inside the 1D, even though they pass through a region where they spatially overlap, essentially, with a two-dimensional electron gas. The coupling between the 2D and the 1D is not sufficient to scatter the electrons in the 1D. There is a different experiment that I can do with this device, and that is to measure the conductance from this tap into the wire. And what I'm doing essentially is now connecting these two resistors in parallel instead of in series. So if I establish a very good contact between the 2D and the 1D in this central tap, I expect the overall resistance to be half the resistance of each part, or twice the conductance twice. And if I have a weak coupling between the 2D and the 1D, just because I restrict the length of this interface, then I expect the conductance to go down accordingly. And we also see this in our experiment. For example, if we have a 2 micron wide tap, the conductance that we measure when there is a single mode in front of both of these gates is small, much smaller than the classical value, which is actually twice the conductance of each wire. These two experiments, as you can guess, are not unrelated. You can relate the two experiments by writing a conductance matrix for this three-terminal device with some simplifying assumptions. This conductance matrix actually has only two parameters. One of them that is the transmission coefficient between the 2D and the 1D. This transmission coefficient is going to depend on the length we allow for the 2D to couple into the 1D. And there is an overall prefactor which has to do with the coupling between the 2D and the 1D for a semi-infinite line. This would be like the emissivity of the contacts, the best emissivity we can achieve for this contact. And we can solve this algebra and predict what would be the overall conductance from far left to far right as a function of this transmission, and also what is the conductance from the tap into the wire. This conductance is actually a direct measure of this transmission coefficient. What we find in our experiments is if we measure this transmission, we can actually predict what would be the result of the second experiment, and the two agree to a very good level, so it builds our confidence in this model. In fact, we can perform more measurements than three parameters, and this model seems to work very nice. So when we measure, we perform these measurements on many devices with various lengths of an interface between the 2D and the 1D in this central tap, we can actually follow the transmission coefficient between the 2D and the 1D as a function of length. And what we find is that when we allow a length of about 6 microns, this transmission is about 1/2. So we can identify this length scale, 6 microns, as the characteristic length scale for coupling between the 2D and the 1D in these samples. And we can then use this information to actually characterize a semi-infinite contact, now taking the limit of an infinite, semi-infinite length of coupling between the 2D and 1D. And a theory for that was written by Ned Wingreen and Amir Jacobi a few years back. I do not want to go into the details, but what it allows us to do is to actually predict what would be the two-terminal conductance, and we indeed find that we expect a non-universal value which corresponds pretty well to the actual measured value. So our aim was to use now the knowledge that we have about these taps into the wire to perform multi-terminal measurements on a wire. And what we would like to do is to make these voltage probes non-invasive or weakly invasive, so we can probe the wire without disturbing it too much. We do that by narrowing this down, and if we use a tap which is 2 micron wide, we can look into the interior of a wire without disturbing it too much. And the result of this experiment, three-terminal resistance experiment, is shown here. What I would like to take from all this data is essentially one number. In order to drive a current from source to drain, we apply some voltage on the source. And the voltage that we measure appearing in this tap is half the applied voltage when the device is symmetric and there is a single mode in front of both gates. We can understand this result by talking about electrochemical potentials of left movers and right movers and what a tap like that will measure. But in fact, this result is trivial just from symmetry. Even if there is a linear voltage probe along the wire, just by the fact that we're probing the voltage halfway down the wire, we must measure half the applied voltage. So if you would like to get more information, we have to break the symmetry. And we do that by complicating the device a little further. We add another gate. We have 3 gates which allow us to separate out 4 distinct regions in the two-dimensional electron gas. 2 of them are going to be semi-infinite interfaces, good contacts. This would be the source and drain. And 2 of them are going to be narrow, and we're going to use them as non-invasive or weakly invasive probes into the wire. This result shows both the 2-terminal and 4-terminal resistance measured on the same piece of wire here in the middle with 6 micron wide taps, and the invasiveness of these taps as measured by measuring the conductance from the tap into the wire is something like 15% or so. What you see is that the 2-terminal resistance grows in a step-like manner. What used to be equally spaced conductance plateaus is now non-equally spaced resistance plateaus just by taking one over the conductance. You also see superimposed on that some resonance structure. We always have that structure to some level in our devices, and it is somewhat emphasized here by the fact that I'm plotting one over conductance. In any case, the four-terminal resistance is much lower than the two-terminal resistance, but it is still finite, it's not zero, and we can ask the question whether this finite invasiveness, this 15% invasiveness of the probe, accounts for this finite four-terminal resistance. Essentially, the existence of the voltage probes couples left movers and right movers, and generates this kind of glitches in the electrochemical potentials along the wire. For weak invasiveness, we're going to have small glitches. For very invasive probes, the gap between the two is going to collapse. So we can relate the measured tap invasiveness to the expected four-terminal resistance, and when we do that, we indeed find that the invasiveness of the ports actually fully accounts for the measured four-terminal resistance. But we can do a bit better than that, in the sense that we can make the probes less invasive by shortening this distance between the gates from 6 microns to 2 microns. Now these probes are much less invasive. The invasiveness is about 4%. And you see that the four-terminal resistance, which used to be about 2.5 kilo-ohms, dropped essentially to zero. So this is the result I started off with. And what I would like to stress is that by using these non-invasive voltage probes, I can indeed observe a vanishing four-terminal resistance in a ballistic wire. And it also clearly shows that the origin for the non-universal two-terminal conductance of Clifford-Jovagross wires has nothing to do with the wire itself. It is a property of the contacts, because the difference between the measured two-terminal resistance and the expected quantum of resistance is this error bar. It is much larger than any fluctuations here in the intrinsic resistance of the wire. We can repeat this experiment with probes with various levels of invasiveness. This is done with many devices. And we can plot the ratio between the four-terminal and two-terminal resistances as a function of the invasiveness, here the transmission from the tap into the wire. These are the experimental points, and the black line is what you would get from a Boutiquer-Landauer type theory calculate the response of such a four-terminal device. So we have reasonable agreement with this model. Some more information that we can extract from our measurements. Instead of measuring the four-terminal resistance, which amounts to the difference, the voltage difference between these two ports, we can ask, as we apply a voltage, what is the absolute voltage that appears in each one of these ports? And the answer is that we get half the applied voltage, both for this tap and for this tap. So even though this tap is located 1/3 of the way down the wire and this one is 2/3, we still measure half the applied voltage in each one of them. So we can sort of imagine an equally divided contact resistance. It divides equally between the two contacts. This number, 1/2 of the applied voltage, brings me to an issue that I mentioned before, and that is what it is exactly that a voltage probe, a non-invasive voltage probe, measures in a ballistic wire. I talked about two distinct electrochemical potentials inside the wire, right movers and left movers. So if the probe, for example, would couple only to right movers, it would measure the electrochemical potential of the right movers. And if it couples only to left movers, it would measure the left movers' electrochemical potential. So only a symmetric probe would actually average these two electrochemical potentials to yield a measurement which is half the applied voltage. In this way, the net current between the wire and the probe is going to be zero, which defines a voltage measurement. So when we fabricate the devices, actually we expect them, from the fabrication point of view, we expect them to be symmetric because we don't do anything to break the symmetry. And it seems like from our measurements we get a result which corresponds to symmetric probes. Let me relate the result of this measurement, the measurement of the electrochemical potential, to a different quantity, that is the electrical potential inside the wire. To make a connection between the two things, one needs to remember that charge neutrality is a condition which is always imposed by a much larger energy scale. That is, the negative charge density of the electrons inside the wire is always fully compensated by a positive background. So if one would like to shift, let's say, the electrochemical potential of left movers or right movers, one always have to accommodate this with a shift in the electrical potential so that the density of the electrons is going to be independent of position and fixed by the background positive charge of the ions. And it's very easy to convince oneself that in order to do that, one needs a step in the potential, which is half the applied voltage at the entrance and half the applied voltage at the end. So with symmetric probe coupling, we end up actually measuring the potential inside the wire, and we find it to be half the applied voltage. But this all relies on the symmetry of the probe-wire coupling, and in fact, we can control this symmetry. We do that by applying a magnetic field, and the idea here is we apply magnetic field perpendicular to the two-dimensional electron guides, and the idea is that the Lorentz force is going to couple electrons in the probe preferentially either to left movers or right movers inside the wire. And what is plotted here is the voltage at the source, both at the first probe and the second probe. These are the blue and purple lines. And the difference between the two, which is the green line, as a function of the magnetic field. What you see is that at zero magnetic field, the two probes measure about half the applied voltage. As I increase the magnetic field, the two of them rise together and finally saturate at the value close to the source voltage. This would correspond to measuring only, say, left movers. And for a negative magnetic field, it drops down and saturates at the value close to the drain voltage. Head at zero, this will correspond to measuring only right movers. So this data is essentially the same as what you would measure in a Hall bar. The only thing is this Hall bar is something like 200 angstroms wide. In fact, the magnetic field at which we observe this saturation in the voltages, 1.2 Tesla, corresponds nicely to the magnetic length associated with this magnetic field, corresponds nicely to the width of our wire. Let me spend the last minutes of this talk talking about recent experiments. These are results that are something like 2 weeks old. And they correspond to some future directions that we would like to take these experiments. It has to do with putting many such gates on the surface and making the wire longer and longer as we add more gates, as we activate more gates. Remember that the isolated wire region corresponds to the place where there is an applied gate voltage which deletes the 2D gas from underneath it. So if we have a sequence of such gates, we can make the same physical wire longer and longer by activating more gates. And the motivation for this experiment was looking for localization in 1D. That is, we expect that as we make even a clean wire longer and longer, eventually at some point due to interference inside the wire, electrons are going to be localized. So there's going to be some localization length which is associated with the small but finite level of disorder in the wire. And what we expect is an exponential growth of resistance with length as we hit this localization length. What we see in the experiment is very different. We measure the resistance as a function of length. Note that we can change the length of the wire from something like 2 microns to something in excess of 20 microns. And what we see is a kind of linear behavior of the resistance with the wire length. The data points are, these points are just the individual gates, wires in front of each one of the individual gates. Then I activate two gates at a time, and I can do that with various adjacent gates. These are these sets of points and so on. So we expect an exponential behavior. We see a linear behavior. And the question is, where does this come from? And the answer to that question is, again, the influence of the existence of these taps on transport. We can actually measure the tap resistance. And this line is not a fit to the data. It actually corresponds to the expected influence of the taps on this resistance. So what we see has to do only with that, and the localization that we were after, is either much smaller or completely absent in this experiment. So with this, let me thank you for your attention. Yes, it goes up, and the surprising thing is that it goes up linearly with lengths rather than.
But you can also measure the same long wire with only one tap on it. Or
with only one gate on it.
Effectively one gate.
Yes, I can do that, but then I would not be able. So then I would need different wires to perform measurements with different lengths. So the advantage here is that I can use the same physical wire to measure the resistance versus length.
With this picture you have changed all, you had inserted a bunch of liquid aspects of one
dimensional. Yes, and actually the only reason I can get away without talking about the Luttinger liquid is the fact that I'm doing linear response at some given temperature. So of course electrons interact, and for example the transmission coefficient between a 2D layer and 1D is going to be influenced by electron-electron interactions. But at some given temperature, this transmission coefficient is going to be some number which I can measure, and as long as I don't vary the temperature or drive the system to nonlinear response, this number is what I have to live with. We did perform some experiments on temperature dependence and applied voltage dependence, but this would be a subject of a different talk.
So do you believe that the temperature dependence in your alpha is arising from
Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the results of experiments having to do with temperature dependence and applied voltage dependence. I don't have the pictures here with me, but when we do this experiment, we can think about an experiment where we have a very narrow tap and we have a small conductance going from this tap into the wire. We can think about it as sort of a tunneling experiment into a wire. So we would expect, for example, the conductance, at least the classical Luttinger liquid predictions would predict that the conductance will go down to zero at zero temperature. What we see in the experiment is that this is not always the case. We get more than we bargained for. We see sometimes the conductance which goes down with temperature with something that would look like a power law, but sometimes the conductance goes down and then changes its mind and goes up as you lower the temperature. And the situation is such that we don't have enough data to sort of sort out what is a generic behavior and what is happening in this system. So we're still accumulating data to try and sort out this behavior.
So the thing that would confuse me about the liquid interpretation is that you still see very flat plateaus. And
this is also true.
You're changing the density of the electrons by a large amount.
Yes.
When you're doing plateaus, and you think that there was an electron
Yes, but one has to remember that I think it's very clear now that this reduction in the conductance has to do with the contacts and not with the wire itself. When you change the gate voltage, you change the density of electrons in the isolated wire region. So the contacts, the density of the 1D in the contact region is kept fixed.
Okay.
So the backscattering lengths may vary from device to device, but it's very long. It's in excess of 20 microns. Sometimes we have devices for which we measure something like 50 microns. Yes, yes. Essentially, what I'm saying here is that I can measure this resistance as a function of length. Then I can go back and measure the conductance of each one of these guys into the wire. And then I can calculate what is the effect of these junctions. And this effect accounts fully for the data. So what that means is that if there is localization in the wire, it's either much smaller or absent altogether. And in fact, what we believe right now is that the existence of a two-dimensional electron gas sheet here in the taps might have a more subtle effect, namely, even if you do not bias these two-dimensional electron gas, there are always some fluctuations, and one has to consider a capacitive coupling between this sheet and the 1D, and what this type of thing will do to the physics of localization. So again, the answer, the true answer to this question is that we didn't accumulate enough data to have concrete statements about that. One hint that we get is this. I told you that if we do a temperature dependence of the conductance, then sometimes we see conductance going down with temperature, sometimes it goes up. And what we found is that we can actually controllably switch between these two behaviors, and we do that by having one additional gate here on the side surface, and we apply small variations in this gate voltage to change the local potential at this junction. And if we look at the conductance at the lowest temperature as a function of this potential, you see a set of resonances. So this is a kind of a hint that it could be that what we're dealing with is resonances of some impurities located at the junction, and they help to mediate transport between 2D and 1D. But I don't know.
Is there not any more questions? Or the last one?
Just a remark, you know, I think one very interesting aspect of this is that when you go to the Latin regime, the thing which flows in the wire is not electrons, but something else, charge density waves.
Mm-hmm.
And is it possible that because of that, the sort of 2D, 1D resistance increases at lower temperatures? Because the overlap between the elementary charge carriers here and there becomes bad just because they are different. Because it's, I think it's an experimental fact that the 1D, 2D resistance decreases with temperature.
Yes, it's a. So it could be, but on the other hand, it could also be that changing the temperature has a much simpler effect in the sense of phonons and things like that. So, I mean, there is a momentum mismatch between the 2D and 1D, and if this momentum mismatch can be supplied, let's say, partly by disorder and partly by phonons, I would also expect the temperature dependent.
So one should look at the wavelength of the thermal phonon in the right range.
Mm-hmm. The wavelengths of the thermal phonon by itself, without disorder, is going to be too long.
Too long.